Blog Talk Radio. What's up? Live tonight. Last week we had had a little mixed down since it was the midterms. So we're back live tonight, November 13th, 2018, 8 o'clock on the East Coast. I'm your host, Ant Canary. This is another live edition of the Ant Canary Experience. Tonight, if you want to call in, 563-999-3682. 563-999-3682. We got a lot to talk about tonight. The main topic of tonight's show is going to be, we're going to be talking about blackface. Because a couple of weeks ago, we had a commentator on TV pretend that she had no idea what blackface was and, you know, how jacked up it is. So we're going to talk about that tonight. I'm going to give you some history on that. Also, I'm going to talk about a few other things before we get into this. As you will know, last week was the midterms, pretty much all over the country. And come January, the government in Washington, D.C. is going to be a whole lot different than it was last Monday. There were a lot of changes. Trump, in my opinion, Trump is in deep shit. Out of all the bragging and all that other mess that his side did, his side is they're in deep shit. And him doing the stuff that he did this weekend, you know, and I understand he's got people that are going to be behind him no matter what. But sometimes it just gets to the point when you're in a fucked up relationship, it's about time for somebody to separate, you know. You get excuse or whatever you want to call it. You're like, you know what? I think it's time we see other people. This guy is a disaster. He shouldn't have been elected president in the first place. The only reason he was elected president, two reasons why. Racism and sexism. The racism comes in that people didn't want, the bigots were tired of seeing a black guy in charge for the first time in this country's history. And the sexism was a lot of those same people did not want a female to be president, which I think would have been a better choice. At least we wouldn't be in the position we're in now. This country is fucked. Whether you want to admit to it or not, and if you don't want to, that's cool. But this guy has no business being president. Who pretty much elected a godfather into the White House because people, for some reason, thought that a businessman was going to fix this country. Businessman is making this country a whole lot worse than it is. He's a bigot. He's full of shit. He don't know what he's doing. He's in over his head. And, you know, and I don't even argue with his supporters anymore because it's a waste of time. You know, you have a better chance of arguing with a toddler. And so, you know, I don't even waste my time. The thing is, you have the proof. It's sitting right in your face. Republicans hate three things: the truth, facts, and videotape. Right in their face, and they still want to believe what they want to believe. They're also still counting votes in Florida and Georgia. The Georgia thing, you talk about voter suppression. Oh, boy. I mean, locking up voting machines, not giving them the proper equipment they need to vote. And then this clown, you know, he's in charge of the votes, and they still let him run. How in the hell can you do that? How do you allow that? I don't understand that. They allow it. And then he decides one day, I think it was one day last week, he decides he wants to, you know, give up the position and then claim that he won. Nobody claimed that you won. This is the kind of underhanded shit that we've been putting up with for years, and it's time for this stuff to stop. It's just stupid. And then Florida, they've got to recount the votes, and now all of a sudden, people on the right are screaming, you know, shady stuff. They can't prove anything, but they're sitting there hollering it. And I posted something pretty much to the fact, you know, if you had an election in Florida, if you had to pick between getting an ice cream cone and getting kicked in the face, 50% would go for the ice cream cone and the other 50% would go for getting kicked in the face. Florida's always jacking something up. And for you old heads, if you remember 2000, when Bush was pretty much given the office of president when he didn't deserve it, you know what happened after that? It's pretty much like whenever you get a Republican in office, the bottom is going to fall out pretty soon. And, you know, if you've been around or read your history, you know what happened after Bush got in. Also, before I forget, yesterday, Stan Lee died unexpectedly. Took me off guard. I saw something on Facebook and was like, wait a minute, I gotta find this out. I gotta make sure, because you know how rumors get started. And come to find out, he did. He's important in my life because I started reading comic books when I was about 10, and I still read them. Watched all the movies, done all that. Whether you know it or not, if you don't read comic books, you probably don't know. Back in the day, there were only two major comic book companies, DC and Marvel. Marvel pretty much almost went out of business, but because of Stan Lee, he pretty much did everything in the early days of this company all by himself. He had a little bit of help, but he pretty much ran the company and, you know, put it in a position where, you know, where it is today. And they've had some struggles and stuff. But, I mean, this man, you know, superhero. Some of you may not know. He just reinvented the genre of comic books. To me, when you read DC and Marvel, I wasn't a DC fan. Superman, Batman, I'll read them if I have to. I don't like them. I'm not a fan of theirs because most of their stories are, they're like fantasy, I guess you could say that. And more Marvel books are more reality. I remember when I was a kid, I always wanted to go to New York to see, see Spider-Man swinging over my head, or Thor, or the Avengers, because I really believe they actually lived in New York, and they didn't. But I thought they did. My first, I'm a big fan of Spider-Man because, you know, I was a nerd in his stories. You know, he was this nerdy guy, with, you know, strong as I don't know what. You know, he could, I mean, a criminal. I mean, he'd be hard. He, you know, pretend to be a nerd, even though he was one of the strongest heroes that, you know, that there was. And, you know, a lot of people like me could relate to that. And, you know, the Marvel movies have, I mean, crazy, and you might not know this, and I've done a story on black superheroes and all that kind of stuff, but Blade, the first Blade, was one of the most successful comic movies, you know, came out, and this what started pretty much the Marvel cinematic universe, even though his character is not in the big, and hopefully, you know, they could. Somewhere, but it could be kind of hard to do because movies were, you know, different studios have them, and, you know, I don't want to scare the. I don't know if I'll be able to see that or not. His stamp on entertainment is, you know, never be the same. You know, he had cameos in most of the Marvel movies. There's one coming out, but there's a couple coming out next year. And hopefully he got he already did work and got his in both of them. But, you know, nerds around the world are upset about what happened. But he had a nice, he'll never be forgotten. I mean, his legacy will live on. And I, for my part, use comic books to My son was into him for a little while. Nephew into him. And I've been reading him ever since. I paid a couple of my cousins that recently passed, and they were into him. We'd get together, and that's pretty much all we used to talk about. Comic books, video games, stuff like that. And I miss him because, you know, we talk about that stuff all the time. You know, hung up, hey, you know, it's like, you know. So, you know, he had a – oh, and I want to say this before we get to the discussion. A lot of people don't know this, but, you know, the X-Men series was based on – it was written back in the 60s when we had the you know, all the stuff going on with the boycotts and all that kind of stuff. And I think I might have mentioned this before, but the characters of Professor X and Magneto were based on Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, because in the X-Men stories, the mutants were hated by the rest of society. Professor X, wanted the mutants to live in harmony with everybody else, while Magneto was pretty much like, nah, screw that. We're more powerful than them. We need to be ruling over them instead of the other way around. So they got into that constant fight against each other because one side, you know, thought they were right. But, you know, Stan Lee was a visionary, and a lot of people don't know this too. There was a thing where Iron Man became a really bad drunk, really bad alcoholic, and his friend took over for him. And his friend was who later became known as War Machine, which was a brother, James Rhodes. And then also the character the Falcon was introduced back in the 60s, a brother, and he became, you know, really good friends with Captain America. And then when Captain America was Steve Rogers was not able to be Captain America, Sam Wilson, so we had a black Captain America. So in Marvel comic books, you know, black people and minorities play a major role, especially in the X-Men, because most of the X-Men, you know, if you got a book that had like all just all the X-Men characters in it, and then you'd have characters from all over the place, all over the world, you know, U.S., Mexico, Canada, South America, England. I mean, everywhere around the world, there was some kind of, you know, X-Men. So you're talking about diverse. The X-Men universe is diverse. From character with their characters all from all over. He was a visionary. So, you know, matter of fact, he was talking about it at work today. You know, got a couple of guys there at work, and we talk about comic books and all the time. And we were pretty much kind of shocked by what happened. But, you know, 95 years old, you know, he lived a life. So he will always be remembered. So I think that's all I want to – I think that's it. Yeah, I think that's all I want to talk about. So if you want to call in tonight. Oh, no. There's one more thing. No, there's a couple more things. Hold on a second. Should have wrote down these notes. I forgot to write the notes down, but a couple more things. Let me just mention this right quick. Trump again. I just remembered. This past weekend, Sunday, Monday, was Veterans Day. And for a guy that's allegedly supposed to be in charge of the military forces in this country, he turned out to be a really big punk. Went over to Paris for the ceremonies for, you know, the end of World War One. He couldn't go to the ceremony because it was raining. Made up an excuse. Everybody else was there but him. They had a wreath laying in Washington yesterday. Don't think he could go to that one either. So for somebody to pretend that they're all in the military, you know, he really did punk out this past weekend. And he wants to get on athletes' cases about taking a knee and doing a nonviolent protest. when this clown can't even, you know, he's not even thinking about the military. He don't care about the military. He's got a whole bunch of troops down at the border for what? For no reason. Because he's scared of brown people coming. You know, and I think I put something, yeah, I put something up today. Would the response be different if these brown people all of a sudden white people, and they were coming? Would the response be different? I believe so. Him and the people that he surrounds himself with, their one goal, which is not going to happen, is that they want this country to go back to just being all white, which it never was. They have this stupid-ass idea in their head that they want, you know, everybody that don't look like them out of the country. They just want, you know, white folk, which is not going to happen. So they can try all they want to. It's not going to happen. Not going to happen. And also, there was an armed security guard that was killed by police, and this guy was doing his job, and the cop shot him. So, you know, if you're one of those people that want to sit up there and just, you know, whatever the cops do is right, no matter what they do, then you're full of shit. This guy was doing his job, breaking up a fight, taking somebody into custody, and the cops roll up and they just shoot him. He had on his uniform. Something wrong, you know, with these, and then these are the same people running around here screaming, you know, whenever somebody says something about gun rights, they don't want nobody to take their gun. But you got these crazy assholes running around here with guns shooting people. You know, I've said this before, and I'll keep saying, I don't care if people agree with me or not. Just because you have a right to own a gun don't mean you should have one. If you're too fucking crazy to own a gun, then you shouldn't have a gun. And don't give me the excuse, you know, you got to have a gun to protect your family. Well, if you're that concerned about protecting your family, you live in a shitty neighborhood, maybe you need to move your family out of that shitty neighborhood. I've lived in some crazy-ass neighborhoods before and never had a gun in my life. So that's just an excuse. But this guy was doing his job, and they shot him and they killed him. Told somebody a couple of days ago, I think black men in this country, you know, were becoming an endangered species because, you know, people seem to think they can just shoot us for no reason and get a paid vacation. You know, it's just retarded. You know, and my thing is, what in the hell a civilian need with a assault rifle? Guns are made to kill. That's it. They're not made to do anything else. But you get the same tired excuses. So now we got a young man, young brother, killed for nothing. Doing his job. Cop will get a nice paid vacation, get a desk job, and then they'll probably just, it's a mistake. It's retarded. It's really retarded. It stinks. 563-999-3682. 563-999-3682. I usually have five clips tonight. But tonight, usually have five clips, so tonight I've got three because some of them are a couple of them are, well, they're all over 10 minutes. But they have information in them. And like I said, we're going to talk about blackface, which it's just, you know, if you don't know, you know, I got these clips off of Facebook. So if you got any questions, you know, you can always go to Facebook and see them. And some of these clips is probably better to see them. You know, you can't see them by listening. You know, you can listen to them, but you can't see the images that go with them. So it's probably better to see this stuff so you get an idea of what we're talking about. You know, these are white actors that, you know, put on black makeup, usually had white around the lips. And it's just, you know, I see, I'm old enough to remember back in the day that some of the Looney Tunes cartoons had Bugs Bunny was in blackface. I'm a big Three Stooges fan, and there's some episodes of Three Stooges where they were in blackface. But they don't show that stuff anymore. Those cartoons, they really don't show those anymore. I mean, there was some. If you really think about it, those some of those cartoons are really racist. But we didn't know. You know, we used to come home from school every day and about 3:30, it'd be Bugs Bunny on TV. We used to have Bugs Bunny on Saturday before we got, you know, they got Cartoon Network and stuff like that. Bugs Bunny was on every Saturday morning. Bugs Bunny was pretty much on 6 days a week. And, you know, he had, I mean, there was episodes when, you know, had black people on them, you know, with rings in their nose and trying to cook people in pots. You know, like I said, he was, there was some episodes he was in blackface. I mean, singing Dixie. I mean, you have to go back and look for these episodes, but there were these episodes out there. And watching this stuff as kids, we didn't know any better. But now you look at that shit now, and it's like, what? I used to look at it. Yeah, you used to look at it. You used to look at it. You know, and they would put that stuff on, and then they would talk, and then, you know, it was just, you know. And then they had one character called Jim Crow. And that's where the Jim Crow, the name Jim Crow comes from for the laws that they had back in the day where black people couldn't do a whole lot of stuff in this country. And I think that it'll be in the first clip I'm going to play. But matter of fact, the clips I'm going to play are going to give you a history. And then the last clip, the anchor person that all of this stuff is about that she ended up losing her job over, she's pretty much going to get schooled on why what she thought was just, you know, she should have known better. But thing with her is she used to work at Fox Noise. So I guess some of that, you know, that channel has been racist from day one. So I guess sometimes, you know, you work for, you know, you sell your soul and you work for a company like that, you kind of forget when you leave that place, how it was before you left. I digress. Well, if you want to call in, 563-999-3682. We'll make room for you. We can talk about this. Or, you know, we just have this another episode where you just sit back and learn. That's cool, too. Next week, we're going to do third annual show on the myth of Thanksgiving. Because, well, I mean, believe it or not, November is halfway over. And next week is Turkey Day, next Thursday, and then after that is Black Friday. And whatever you thought about or didn't know about Thanksgiving, you'll find out about that next week. Oh, yeah, and that's a 90-minute episode next week because I think a lot of people won't be able to sit down and listen because they're going to be busy doing other things, which is fine. But, you know, if you're able to listen, listen. If you're able to call. If not, just sit back and listen. Not able to listen live on Tuesday, always catch it in the archives. But, you know, the story of Thanksgiving is not all what it's cracked up to be. And matter of fact, when I started doing this and back in 2015, doing the research on this, I had no idea. And it just, you know, turned me around big time. So now to me, Thanksgiving, you know, to most people it's a holiday, but to me it's a regular Thursday. It don't even, you know, only difference is that, you know, I get to eat a whole lot of good food. I get to get eat a sweet potato pie, not pumpkin pie, but sweet potato pie. Eat all the turkey and ham and greens and stuffing or dressing, mac and cheese, not no green bean casserole, collard greens, mustard greens, tater salad. Oh, my goodness. So that's only different. As far as I'm concerned, that's only different. To me, it's just a regular Thursday because I have to work. Friday, there's no way in hell I mess with Black Friday because that's all of that's a gimmick anyway. And I have to work retail, so I know it's a gimmick. Don't fall for it. Don't fall for that mess. Because the same stuff that they want you to go break your neck for on that Friday morning, as long as they have it in stock, every week the price will drop. It'll keep dropping until they get rid of it. And this week, it's on Christmas is on a Tuesday. So they get an extra weekend. So if you don't have it by then, you know, there's no need to go to Walmart and beat people down for a toy for your kid. And I've got kids, and I know how kids are. You know, they want, give me, give me, give me. Then as soon as they get it, they'll play with it for 2 seconds. And then it's in the closet. It's under the bed. It's broke. You know, it's just the way it is. But, you know, one thing I like about today's kids, speaking of, you know, buying, breaking, you know, fighting for toys, like these kids, they have no imagination whatsoever. We used to play army men and race cars with tracks and trains and all kind of stuff. And we used to use imagination to play with this stuff. These kids today, they have no imagination whatsoever. I don't even see the little green army men anymore because, you know, if they want to play army now, they just throw in a video game. No imagination whatsoever. So, you know, if you got kids, don't go to Walmart beating people up over that stuff. Not even worth it. It's not worth it. If you don't know the myth about Thanksgiving, if you don't know what that's about, join me next week, and I'll tell you all about it. It's pretty banged up. It's pretty banged up. So, with that, we're going to talk about, I'm going to play this first clip. And this is, you know, gives you the history on blackface. It'll do a better job than me trying to explain it to you. And like I said, if you can, get on you can on YouTube, check out the clips and see what the deal is. Okay? All right. So we're going to play first clip, and then we'll be right back. Let me get out the call-in number if you want to call in. 563-999-3682. 563-999-3682. Be right back.
The Blackface Minstrel Show is considered to be the first distinctly American theatrical form. The Minstrel Show was popular from the early 19th to the early 20th century and was founded on the comic enactment of racial stereotypes. Minstrel shows also imitated and offensively exaggerated African American music, culture, vernacular English, physical traits, and more, all for entertainment. The most common form of this was the use of blackface.
Two quiet people, Cotton Watts and Chick.
Well, lady, let that be a lesson to you.
What's the matter with you boys shooting up that man's hen house?
I'll shoot any chicken trying to follow me home.
Well, why don't you get a job and go to work?
Y'all almost had me a job this morning.
Where?
I went down to the post office and asked that man, could he let me have one of them jobs as a letter total?
No, Cotton, you mean a mail carrier.
And the man said, would you give me a situation, he'd have to put me through a simple self-examination.
No, stupid. You mean a civil service examination.
Well, the man carried me in a little room and set me down and started asking me a gang of questions.
Well, what'd he ask?
First thing the man asked me, say, how far is it from the sun to the moon?
He asked you how far it was from the sun to the moon?
Yeah, that's what the man asked me.
Well, what'd you tell him?
I told him if he was going to give me that route, I didn't want the job.
Well, tell me, how would you like to go to work for me?
Yes, ma'am. How much you going to pay me, I hope?
Well, let's see now. I'll pay you all your worth.
No, ma'am. I gotta have some money.
You know, Cotton, I'm making a picture called The Lion Tamer.
The Lion Tamer?
Uh-huh.
There ain't but one kind of lion I'll mess with.
What kind's that?
Ooh, that's a dandelion.
Now, all I want you to do is meet me at the zoo in the morning at 9 o'clock.
Yeah, with the rest of the monkeys.
With the rest of the monkeys.
Yeah, I'll bring my grandpa with me.
I want to get a moving picture of you in the lion's cage.
Well, if you ever do get a picture of me in a lion's cage, you'll be moving all right.
Oh, Cotton, the lion can't hurt you.
Can't hurt me. My nobody make me hurt myself.
Why, the lion's tame. He'll eat right off your hand.
Eat over your hand and over your leg, too. I know them cats.
But you don't understand, Cotton. The lion was raised on milk.
Raised on milk? Uh-huh. I was too, but I eat pork chops now.
Why, it can't bite you. you.
Now, how come he can't bite me?
He hasn't got a tooth in his head.
I know, but he can gum me to death. I don't want him gnawing on me.
Now, all I want to do is snap you as you enter the lion's cage.
You just want to snap me as I enter?
Yes.
Well, you better snap me as I enter, because you will never be able to focus me when I start out, because I'm Alabama bound.
Recorded blackface performances can be traced back to the early 1600s in William Shakespeare's Othello. Out of necessity, black people were not allowed to perform on stage and had limited rights in Europe. There were blackface performances in America since 1769, when Lewis Hallam Jr. portrayed a drunken black man in the play The Padlock. In the 1800s, localized versions of the blackface clown with a curly wig and painted face were popular. After the War of 1812, Americans yearned to separate themselves culturally from their European counterparts. However, it was Englishman Charles Mathews who took the first major leaps in minstrelsy. Charles Mathews is considered to be the father of American minstrelsy. He toured the southern slave states to create a one-man minstrel show in 1822. Alternatively, Thomas Rice truly popularized blackface minstrelsy in the United States with a song entitled Jump Jim Crow, which was written by Rice in 1828.
Come listen, all you gals and boys, I'm just from Tuckahoe. I'm going to sing a little song, my name's Jim Crow. Wheel about and turn about and do just so. Every time I wheel about, I jump Jim Crow.
The song was wildly successful, and Jim Crow became a euphemism for the African Americans, ultimately blurring reality and entertainment. Consequently, this is where we get Jim Crow laws. Minstrel shows became hugely popular in the 1840s, exposing white audiences in the North to any depiction of black life. They would often feature a broadcast of characters, from Zip Coon, the educated free black man who pronounced everything incorrectly, to Mammy, a fat, black, faithful slave who was really just obviously played by a man in a dress.
Blockaded on the south, encircled in the east, and stalemated on the west. As a matter of fact, Colonel, we're caught with our tents down.
Our army's in a very precarious position.
If the Confederates hear about this, we're lost, sir.
If we all can get that map down to his headquarters, we all could win this war.
Then we all could get married.
Brother, you all ejaculated a mouthful. We all gonna get that map.
Oh, way down south in New York City, the cotton grows on the trees so pretty.
On the trees? On the trees? In the south?
South Brooklyn. Oh, south of the Bronx where I was born. The songs are rotten and the jokes are corn.
Look away! Get away!
Get away! Chris, we're hungry.
Black children were depicted as unkempt and ill-raised pickaninnies. The running joke about pickaninnies was that they were disposable and easily killed because of their stupidity and lack of parental supervision. Blackface minstrel shows started as a small aspect of entertainment, but quickly became full-length shows. The Virginia Minstrels, created by Dan Emmett, were the first to give a full-length minstrel performance, also giving audiences an entire evening of entertainment. Their show featured skits, music, dance, and they were a success in America and abroad. One troupe in particular, Christie's Minstrels, standardized their performance into three separate acts.
Some folks like to sigh, some folks do, some folks do, some folks long to die.
The first act opened with a song, then featured wisecracking banter between the straight man master of ceremonies and the more comic and silly music performers. This chit-chat act later led to duo-type performances between Mr. Tambo, the tambourine player, and Mr. Bones, the bones or spoons player. The second act featured a fractured play, which was often Shakespeare, or a dance performance with a featured guest of high talent, like William Henry Lane or John Diamond. The third act usually opened with a pun-filled stump speech and a large musical number using all the dancers and musicians.
Like this gold, some folks do, some folks do, they'll soon be dead and cold, but that's not me nor you. Love lives a merry, merry heart, laugh by night and day, like the green of it, no matter what some folks say. Some folks get gray hairs, some folks do, brooding o'er their cares. But that's not me nor you. Long live the merry, merry heart. That's my night and day. Like the queen of earth, no matter what some folks say. Some folks toil and save. Some folks do to buy themselves a grave. But that's not me nor you.
After the American Civil War, African Americans began to fill the roles in blackface minstrelsy, first with painted faces and then without. In horrifying irony, white audiences would reject black performers not wearing blackface as not appearing to be black enough. When African Americans performed in blackface minstrel style, producers and audiences expected these performers to use black stage dialect, dance certain specialized routines, and movements. In 1876, Callender's Minstrels was the first all-black cast to perform blackface without makeup. Black performers taking off blackface makeup was an important act in the history of minstrelsy and in stereotypes of black people. They took off the makeup but continued to perform minstrel style, which blurred the lines between real black culture and contrived stage black impersonations. Vaudeville was a new type of entertainment in the early 20th century, and it featured a string of acts including acrobats, animal acts, dancing, songs, magicians, comedy, and other performances. As vaudeville eased its way into the medium of radio in the 1920s, minstrel skits aired on amateur radio. The earliest known attempt at blackface on radio is the rare show Two Black Crows that ran in the mid-1930s. Minstrelsy desensitized Americans to the horrors of chattel slavery. These performances were object lessons about the harmlessness of Southern slavery. And by encouraging audiences to laugh, they showed bondage as an appropriate answer for the lazy and ignorant slave. Minstrelsy ultimately became America's first national popular culture. Blackface was used to push products from cigarettes to pancakes, while minstrel songs were turned into sheet music sold and sung around the world. Children's rhymes and games are also drawn from our minstrel past. Eeny, meeny, miny, moe initially commanded that the listener catch a nigger by his toe. Do Your Ears Hang Low was originally the 1829 song entitled Zip Coon. The story of the children's book, Ten Little Monkeys, was first published as Ten Little Nigger Boys, where each boy was killed as the story progressed. Blackface became a mainstay of stage and later film performance in the 20th century. Most often, blackface was used as a comic device that played on the stereotypes of black laziness, ignorance, war-crossed behavior for laughs. The bitter truth is that we still see blackface today, just not in the same form as we've seen 100 years ago. Remnants range from maple syrup to internet vines about black people going crazy for fried chicken and watermelon. This form of oppression contains an important factor, which relies in media portrayal. In the text Darkest America, Taylor and Austin noted that whites could feel good after seeing black minstrelsy. It confirmed and reinforced white ideas about the inferior nature of blacks and the merits of continuing their degradation by staging elaborate plantation fantasies in which blacks were happy and foolish, while the whites, by implication at least, were benevolent and protective. This implicit thinking dramatically contributes to the persistent impression of blacks in special regards to certain factors such as the media. To this, equal and positive representation will ultimately call for black liberation.
Okay. All right. I'm trying to set it, and I'm not sure if I'm not. Okay. All right. So that's the first clip. The second clip is entitled Blacks in Vaudeville. And the first clip kind of mentions something about vaudeville. But this clip gets into a little bit more detail about what part did blacks played and that type of entertainment. Yeah, a lot of this stuff, you know, you have to see it to understand, you know, how somebody, you know, and they made mention in this too, Aunt Your Mama, yep, on the pancake boxes, the guy on the Cream of Wheat. Whenever you get a chance, Google some of the old ads that they used to have back in the day, where they had black people, I mean, exaggerated lips, eyes, you know, you see some of that stuff and it's like you shake your head. It's like, this is crazy. And I mean, and they could get away with it. I mean, they got away with it for years. They could, you know, show black people any old kind of way, you know, with big lips and, you know, when they did do the shows on TV, you know, Africans, you know, they had really big lips. Some of them, they had chains, you know, gold bands around their necks. I mean, just jacked up. So yeah, if you get a chance, you know, Google ads, you know, black ads back in the 1800s, 1900s. You see what I'm talking about. Next clip. Play it and be right back. Give me 1 second.
Joining me now, co-host of PBS's In Principle, Amy Holmes.
Having technical issues. Looks like the third clip will work, but I want to get the second clip to work. So I'll tell you, we may have to flip them. Let's flip them. Let's do the third clip first, and then that's, if I can get the second clip to run, then we'll do that. Let's do this. Or not. Let me try something.
As each new immigrant group got more of a foothold in America, they filled more theater seats, and what they saw of themselves on stage changed for the better. Vaudevillians knew you don't get nasty about the Irish in a theater full of Irish. But with African Americans segregated in the balcony, or excluded entirely from the audience, there was no such thing in mainstream vaudeville as a theater full of them. And it was that way for almost a century.
Hey, Skinny! The minstrel show's coming to town!
Beginning in the 1840s, the minstrel show was America's first entertainment craze.
It started with northern white performers who observed blacks or Negroes or slaves at that point, really entertaining themselves.
Say, I have an idea.
Yes.
You be around here about a half hour before the show.
You mean you're gonna let me watch up close?
Jim Crow, you'll practically be right on the stage.
Woo! Wheel about and turn about, change and
wheel about and turn about and do just so. Every time I wheel about, I jump Jim Crow.
Give me back my clothes, please.
What they did was to imitate some of the actions they saw, some of the songs that they saw these slaves singing, and to put on grease paint or blackface.
Blacks had little power to protest their characterizations, although many tried. Whites could parody them, but they could parody no one but themselves. Eventually, African Americans formed their own minstrel companies, billing themselves as real Negro delineators. Whites couldn't compete with their authenticity and often their talent, so they turned their own minstrel shows into vaudeville, but blackface characterizations were still an essential part of the act.
That's what the minstrels are here for, so gallant here for, so grand.
As each new immigrant group got more of a foothold in America, they filled more theater seats, and what they saw of themselves on stage changed for the better. Vaudevillians knew you don't get nasty about the Irish in a theater full of Irish. But with African Americans segregated in the balcony, or excluded entirely from the audience, there was no such thing in mainstream vaudeville as a theater full of them. And it was that way for almost a century.
Hey, Skinny! The minstrel show's coming to town!
Beginning in the 1840s, the minstrel show was America's first entertainment craze.
It started with northern white performers who observed blacks or Negroes or slaves at that point, really entertaining themselves.
Hey, I have an idea.
Yes.
You be around here about a half hour before the show.
You mean you're gonna let me watch up close?
Jim Crow, you'll practically be right on the stage.
Woo! Wheel about and turn about, change and
wheel about and turn about and do just so. Every time I wheel about, I jump Jim Crow.
Give me back my clothes, please.
What they did was to imitate some of the actions they saw, some of the songs that they saw these slaves singing, and to put on grease paint or blackface.
Blacks had little power to protest their characterizations, although many tried. Whites could parody them, but they could parody no one but themselves.
Thank you.
Eventually, African Americans formed their own minstrel companies, billing themselves as real Negro delineators. Whites couldn't compete with their authenticity and often their talent. So they turned their own minstrel shows into vaudeville. But blackface characterizations were still an essential part of the act.
That's what the minstrels are here for, so stand up and cheer for the grand old minstrel there.
At the same time, African Americans were being lynched by the hundreds and shunned by mainstream society. They were the subjects of the most popular music of the time, so-called coon songs, that, like minstrel shows, depicted black life as free, careless, and non-threatening to anyone. Whites were led to believe that this young man's sole desire was to sing and dance for them.
If I saw a blackface performer at that time, I guess I was in my early teens, I didn't think anything of it because it was the time that I was living. It was the late 20s. I can look back now. I dislike having to say this, but I realize my mother and father were bigots. But I think everybody in Chicago were bigots.
Sitting by the river on a summer evening, listening to the hum.
White vaudevillians maintained that white fantasy begun during minstrel times, that separate but equal was okay with Mammy, and that blacks were simple, happy creatures who loved to entertain and had lots of time to do it, with just a little cotton picking here and there between fish fries and steamboat arrivals.
Listening to the steamboat blow.
The myth lasted a very long time, as Topsy and Eva, vaudeville's Duncan sisters, were still working it in 1960. The Duncans were the last minstrels. Real African Americans were forced to go along with the myth by wearing ridiculous or stereotype clothing on stage, and only playing versions of Sambo or Zip Coon.
Because Sambo was the willing retainer, he was that slave who would sing songs like Carry Me Back to Old Virginia. On the other hand, Zip Coon then becomes an aggressive black man who's still ignorant, but is pretentious.
Black performers almost always had to be in a racial context.
I don't know why I'm feeling way.
Eunice Wilson sings a fine number that has nothing to do with fruits and vegetables. So why does she have to do it in front of giant watermelons?
I remember once I had added a wonderful song called Shoeshine Boy to my repertoire. And it was a perfect song for a kid of 12, 13 to sing. And I sang this song. I had an arrangement of it with an orchestra and so forth. And I was booked into the Oriental Theater in Chicago. And there was a wonderful theater with a wonderful line of chorus girls and a great choreographer and producer and so forth. And when she heard about the colored boy coming to work at the theater, her mind began to click, apparently, and when I got there, she had a whole big production number about Shoeshine Boy, and of course, I was in it, and I had to give up my nice arrangement and then perform in her production, which included running up and down the chorus girls in front of them with a shoeshine cloth and shining their shoes. And my nice white tail suit had been tossed aside, and I was wearing some kind of stylized version of tatters and rags. That was my final week in vaudeville.
Now, I remember as a kid, you know, hold on there now. Now, Sapphire done told me that you owes me a nickel.
And I used to go like, why do you talk like, to my mother, why do you talk like that?
The white performers who did minstrelsy did not really do black comedy at all. I mean, the jokes had nothing to do with blacks whatsoever. They were basically gags that were taken, and they were of show business origin. They were riddles and gags taken from the northern stage. When blacks came in, you had the emergence of an authentic form of black entertainment, although they still veiled it with the stereotypes that had been set up by the white performers.
The definition for acting is to do. All of this is an act.
Leonard Reed is an African-American who played in both all-white and all-black vaudeville.
I told you why they put on Cork. Not to be black, but to get the expressions from the face. When you put on Cork and white lips, you can move your lips around and everybody can see them moving around, and that's a laugh. And I think anything that you can do to get a laugh should be in show business. Show business is show business.
And I think that burnt Cork for a lot of those vaudevillians was a mask so that when they came off stage, they could disappear into the crowd and nobody would know who they were.
Almost all the black comedians before 1950 wore blackface, even for black audiences. In the beginning, they had to.
Yeah, let me tell you about that bull of my father. You see, right,
but some wanted to, like the great comedian Dewey Pigmeat Markham.
5 o'clock. And that bull is so fast and so smart, every afternoon about 5 o'clock, he goes way up to the far end of that pasture and race that train 5.5 miles.
Oh, yeah?
Would you believe it? That bull beat that train by 0.5 mile.
No.
Mm-hmm.
Some bull.
I know it's some bull.
And when Pigmeat took off his cork, he lost the edge that he had in laughter. I said, Pigmeat, what's happening? I said, the bit is going. He said, I don't know, I can't express myself anymore. He said, they made me take off the cork, and the cork was not to prove that I was black. They knew I was black. He said, but I, Negro, that's what he said, but I just lost the edge. I can't feel like I felt when I had the cork on. And he was brokenhearted till the end. Pigmeat was brokenhearted till the end that he had to take off cork.
Pigmeat Markham was one of the last American performers to take off the mask. His fans were surprised to discover that his face was darker than his makeup. He had been lighting up, not blacking up, for 40 years. In mainstream vaudeville, only one black act was allowed per show, if that. But black performers did have a place to work and learn their craft, the Toba Circle.
The TOBA circuit consisted of a whole black theater circuit consisting, starting with Chicago Grand Theater to St. Louis to Kansas City to Tulsa to Oklahoma City. Yeah, I get excited just thinking about, you know, realize this has been 70 years ago since I did these dates.
On the Toba circuit, monologist Moms Mabley developed a routine that spanned 6 decades.
They fired me. Of course, when they fired me, when I lose my job, I lose my man. That is, since I got well. Kind of old, you know. Now, don't get me wrong. It ain't no disgrace to be old. But, darn, if it ain't inconvenient, I can tell you that much about it. Knock me out, folks. I love the dance. At least I used to love the dance.
Am I blue?
There was a lot for artists to be blue about working Toba, an acronym that stood for Theater Owners Booking Association. But for performers, it always meant tough on black asses. White owners, bad theaters, hardly any pay, and mostly in the South.
'Cause there was a time when I was his only one, but now I'm the sad and lonely one, darling.
They call up and say, Bailey, we got a nigger here says he's yours. His name is so-and-so, and Bailey would say, yeah, that's one of my niggers. He's at the theater. Let him alone. And they would let him go. You could not walk the street after dark in the South?
Pardon me. Ladies and gentlemen, I like it this time.
Phone just rang.
This one here?
Didn't you hear it?
Oh, no, I didn't. Hello?
What's the matter with this guy?
Yes? Mr. Reed's office.
Must
Mr. Reed?
Yes, for you.
Must be for me.
Got to make him think you're big time. Yeah. Always have a secretary.
He's big. Hello? Yes?
Leonard Reed and Willie Bryant became stars at the Apollo in New York, like the Toba Theaters, a place where African-American performers could work before their peers to find their own voices in their own communities. But to become national stars, they had to deal with the white world, and that was really easy.
As a young black performer, I was not allowed to stay in many of the hotels where I worked. I think that's, to people who are young today, unimaginable, but it's quite true.
We never saw them at the same hotel we stayed at. And they tried to keep this from the kids. But I knew as a kid that the black people and the ethnic people had to go miles out of the way to get to a boarding house or get to a place that would serve them food.
If it was a white, you know, bill, and the white audiences, white people on the stage and everything, they would want us to stay in a black hotel, you know. But, and that's another thing where my brother and I, we sort of tried to clip that down too, you know. And go stay in the hotels where the other people stayed.
Hey, that's mommy.
Yeah?
Yeah, man.
Well, okay, then.
Put my trunk in goof of dust. Cause you know someday may bring you a seven.
Through talent, courage, and a refusal to be stereotyped, some performers overcame, like the Nicholas Brothers.
Yeah!
Naturally, we're going to say no if they ask us to blackface and put on tramp singing.
No, they never did ask us that. I mean, in all the years that we've been in show business, I think they thought we'd be out of character to do that because they always see us in the tuxedos and the tails with class and grace and all that.
Maybe that's why we never got too many parts in movies, you know, because we wouldn't do the mammy thing, you know, and stuff like that. So.
Huey Blake always wore a dinner jacket on stage. He was proud of his music and insisted on showing that pride. Of all the vaudeville performers who overcame huge obstacles to achieve success and dignity, the first, the greatest, was Burt Williams. He started out a minstrel in 1893 and by 1910 was the most respected comedian on the American stage.
Burt Williams' Sambo character, although he himself said it was the same shuffling nigger that was being portrayed by other people, was done with such subtlety that he came across as a human being.
Burt Williams mesmerized the audience. As a matter of fact, one of the bits that he did in the 1919 Follies was a shoe store, and he describes how the shoes are too tight. And my dad, who was a straight man, he says, well, what size do you wear? He says, well, I wear 10s, but 11s feel so good, I wear 12s.
He just seemed to relax, and everyone knew there was going to be a punchline, but he waited. And waited, and he milked it for all it was worth, and then he would say the punchline very calmly. And his sense of timing was remarkable.
Sat on his knees, as a matter of fact, when I was about 5 years old. He was a very nice, kindly gentleman. And all business.
In the 1916 film, The Natural Born Gambler, Burt Williams recreated one of his most famous sketches, a mime poker game performed alone. Williams was, as Robert Townsend says, the Jackie Robinson of show business. Not only the first black American to star with an otherwise white cast on Broadway, but the first black American in our history to be admired and respected by people of all races. He died in 1922, only 46 years old. He worked himself to death, trying to prove something he had already proved decades before. Many times over.
What am I proudest of? I'm proudest of that the brother and I, or me, got the opportunity to do what we wanted to do on stage. And nothing took that away from us. You know? We did it all.
That was the last clip, so I'm going to try to play this. Not the second clip. Try to play this last clip. Looks like I'm having some issues. Let me see if this last clip will play. Looks like I'm having issues, technical issues. But let me check. Let's play this last one.
Joining me now, co-host of PBS's In Principle, Amy Holmes, and host of the digital show Roland Martin Unfiltered. Roland Martin, I love you guys. Thank you so much for that. Love you, too. Thank you both for being here. It's not an easy discussion, but Roland, I did listen yesterday, and what was very clear in what I read and what I heard is that the history here, when it comes to that term and this issue, is deeply disturbing.
I think the problem is, for African Americans, we know the history, and too many white Americans don't know or won't accept it. And the reality is, it is American history, yours and mine. You look at blackface, white entertainers wore blackface to mimic African Americans, to caricature African Americans. When you look at the minstrel shows, black entertainers were forced to wear blackface because whites did not even want to see the humanity of black people, so therefore they had blackface. Last night I looked at Spike Lee's 2000 movie Bamboozled, which dealt with this, and they actually, Jada Pinkett Smith character actually talked about exactly how they created it. What they did was they poured alcohol on two corks, burned it to a crisp, mashed it to a powder, added water, and mixed it to a thick paste, and then applied it to the faces of black people. Then they would take red lipstick and put it on the lips, but then on the outside of the lips to create this image. But this thing went beyond just that. You look at the Jim Crow Museum that's at Ferris State University, where this is American history, where black people have been assaulted in magazines, television, radio, all of these images that have continued for centuries and then, of course, decades, going up to the 1960s and to some degree in the 70s, and we still see it present day. And so this is American history. The problem is too many of us grew up learning his story and not actual history. And that's the problem that we have to accept. And when we are grown, when we are educated, we have to go beyond what we were taught, what we learned in our households, and say, I better be fully aware of real American history as opposed to being in denial about what actually took place in this country.
Mm-hmm. And the other piece of it is that seeing a white person darken her skin, even for a costume, today evokes that past.
Well, absolutely it does. It does, because you're speaking to, again, a history. Look, if you want to dress up like James Earl Jones and come into America, somebody sent me a photo, you can put the costume on. You don't have to darken your face. We have to deal with also the reality of colorism in this country, that the American beauty standard since we were created, because this is about whiteness, okay? If we really want to be honest, America was created to be a white nation. The beauty standard was a blonde, blue-eyed, white woman. And so black women have had to deal with the critique of their hair, their lips, and their hips, and all of that. And so when you have to deal with that, you're understanding how deep this thing is. This is the 50th anniversary of King's assassination, the 50th anniversary of the Fair Housing Act, but also the 50th anniversary of the Kerner Commission report, which said there were two white Americas, one white, one black. Most black folks who even came into journalism came in after the Kerner Commission, which was all based upon race riots. And so media, the reason this story boomeranged all around is because media has been the main driver of these racist caricatures throughout American history, and that's why it's such a huge story.
Mm-hmm. What did you think?
I'll be honest, when I saw the headlines, I cringed, and I was like, oh, dear, that it does need to be talked about. And I had the sense that maybe there was a bit of a blind spot and an overcorrection of an overcorrection, if you know what I mean. That the history of blackface, as Roland laid out, is the caricature of African Americans as mentally diminished, emotionally immature, subservient, all for to mock African Americans for white entertainment. And maybe this was something that wasn't fully understood. But I did understand the idea of, but I love this character. I love Diana Ross, or, you know, any number of African-American characters and real people historically. But even there, Megan, Hollywood also has a disreputable history of hiring white actors to play ethnic minorities because of racist casting practices. So instead of hiring a talented black actor or Native American or Hispanic American, you'd have a white actor putting on dark face to play that character. Even if it was meant to be respectful or thoughtful and reflective, it still reflected in our culture a non-acceptance of ethnic minorities in media representation.
Not even actor. I know people, no one wants to talk about Bill Cosby these days. But the reason there was a Black Stuntmen Association is because Bill Cosby was standing next to, when he was doing I Spy, and they had a scene, an action scene, and it was a white man who was putting on blackface to be his stunt double. Bill Cosby said,
what?
No. Y'all go hire somebody black. That's what led to the creation of the Black Stuntmen Association. There was a documentary that was done on them. That was in the 60s. This is American history. We live in constant denial. Today, we're dealing with Confederate statues and monuments, and people are saying, well, okay, this is really no big deal why you're upset. But we have to recognize, I'll be 50 years old November 14th. How many universities have we seen where they've had thug parties and ghetto parties where white fraternities and sororities dressing up in afros and blackface and wearing grills and putting on big chains to mimic African Americans? Well, you want to mimic a rapper, mimic the white rappers out there, dress up like Eminem. But no, that's not exactly what it's done. That is a caricature. And when you have that constant assault, what people don't understand is that black people in America, next year will mark the 400th anniversary of the first 20-odd Africans arriving in this country in August of 1619 in Virginia. For 399 years, this constant assault, this degradation, and this demeaning of how we look and how we act. We are just 50 years removed from Dr. King's assassination. In 25 years, Megan, we will be a majority nation people of color. And white America has to come to grips with that, because now that's going to mean power, that's going to mean economics, it's going to mean that, look, that that the notion of what is considered American values will have to be now looked at differently because people of color will be also making that determination, not just white Americans.
How do we talk about race and our country's history with race and have a real conversation?
Well, I think with information, with sensitivity, and with also the knowledge that as a country, we have struggled, paid a very dear price, and we continue to do to try to be a country where we have dignity toward each other and different racial groups. So the Halloween costume controversy, to me, the line is actually not that difficult to draw. There's a difference between dressing up as, say, you know, a character with clothing, those types of things, versus racial mockery. And painting blackface, well, so are you going to do the lips? Are you going to do, like, where does that go? Your producers asked me, well, what would be an example that I think is okay? I think little kids all across America, if they want to dress up like the Disney princesses from Frozen, go for it. Wear the gown. Wear the sparkles. But it would certainly be very strange if that turned into some sort of, like, ethnic mockery on that part. Mm-hmm. Do you see what I'm saying?
Plus, you got to realize how powerful colorism is. Zoe Saldana is a woman of color who got highly criticized because they darkened her skin when she played Nina Simone. Because that went into why couldn't you hire a dark-skinned woman to play the role? Yep. You ask the question, how do you have the conversation? Here's the thing that we don't want to accept. This is what I call an informal gathering. No one person could control who sits in this audience. But we control who we eat lunch with. We control who we go to dinner with. We control who we invite to our houses. And if we really want to be honest, Americans live in silos. White folks stay with white folks. Black folks stay with black folks. Latinos stay with Latinos. Asians with Asians. Native Americans with Native Americans. And it's rare when in voluntary situations we actually cause ourselves, I need to learn more about you. I need to understand you and where you come from. But also asking the question, I don't know. I worked with a guy, Tim Madigan, who grew up in Iowa, didn't see black people until he went to college. All these racial things happen. He never understood why black folks responded the way he did until he wrote the book on the Tulsa race riot. And then he began to interview, and he hears these stories of elderly black people kneeling in their homes and guns put to the back of their head, and they were killed based upon a lie, and how this whole town was destroyed. Tim said, Roland, for the first time, I then understood why black people felt the way they did. And he said, as a white man, I had to force myself to own up to my lack of understanding, my lack of history. And I would say the same thing, Megan, whether it's you, whether somebody sitting in this audience, being honest that, wait a minute, how did I grow up? And have to go inside of yourself and say, what was I taught? What did my parents teach me? What did my friends teach me? And do I allow people to say things around me that have racial implications and I say nothing? Because I don't really want to upset the apple cart. Let me look at who's in my office. Who's on my staff? Who are executives? I've been in media since I was 14 years old. One of the fundamental problems we have is that white men still run media across the board. Mm-hmm. Do understand, and this is just understand how this thing impacts us. When I sat with Ken Jout, the executive vice president at CNN, when I did a pilot, he literally, I used the word brother. I was interviewing the guy who later became the first black president. And I talked about health care, and I said, man, that really hurt a brother having to file for bankruptcy because of health insurance. He said to me, hey, you know, be careful using the word brother because we don't want to alienate white viewers and being too ethnic. And I'm going, but that's my story, and I was talking to a black man. But Glenn Beck could use the word brother, and it's perfectly fine. And the fact that he would say that to me in that context is, wait a minute, hold up, why can't I just be me? Why is it that, okay, you're too black, Roland? Well, how am I too black? Because I am black. And so we have to understand how deep this goes, because now it impacts raises, it impacts promotions, it impacts who we work with. And so we, I think, are in total denial of how deeply embedded race is in the DNA of America and how it impacts so many of the things that are done in this country. And if we have a discussion and just be honest, and somebody says, look, I don't know, share with me, educate me. That also, I think, what changes it.
And on a personal level, for all of us to challenge stereotypes that we may have about different racial and ethnic groups and say, wait a minute, is that fair, the way that I'm relating to other people or making assumptions? That's a part, I think, of the journey. But the last point is, I can play Diana Ross. I'm sorry, Megan, you can't.
No. Megan,
you can.
No, Megan, you can play Diana Ross just like you can play any other character, but you just put on a gown, grab a fan, and then have big hair, you're fine. But that's the mistake that we make when we say, oh, I want to cross that line.
Yeah.
There are lines, and there's history, and there's pain. And when we acknowledge that, then we can learn and grow from it. But as long as we as Americans live in denial and act as if that stuff does not matter, then we will continue to have this problem in the next 400 years.
Listen, well said. All I can say is, for my part, I have been listening and learning, and I'm grateful to both of you to have this conversation here on the set today, and to those who reached out to me via Twitter. I've heard you too. Thank you. Thank you very much, and we'll be right back.
Okay, that was the last one. And like I said, I usually have five, but today I'm only having three. And it looks like my board is going nuts for some reason. I don't know what the deal is tonight. So what I'm going to have to probably end up doing, I don't even know if I can take calls or not. Let me try something. I don't think I can take calls. I think the board is going crazy for some reason. I think this is some kind of technical thing going on with it. So unfortunately, I'm going to have to end the show early because I don't know what's happening. Let me try something. Let me hold on 1 second. Let me see something here. If I could let me one cooperate. All right. Well, I'm going to have to cut the program a little short tonight, unfortunately. Having technical issues. But let me say this before I go. Hopefully it won't cut me off before I do anything. And every now and again, it does this. So it's no big deal. Most of the show is done anyway, so we're good. But the only thing I can't do is take calls right now. And I've got two on hold, and it's giving me hell. So anyway, the only thing I can do is say thank you for listening. And I'll be back next week. Hopefully I won't have these issues next week. Remember, we're going to be doing the show on Thanksgiving. And hopefully next week when you call in, I'll be able to grab the phone calls. Tonight, for some reason, I'm just having technical issues out of my control. But thank you for everybody listening. Thank you for the phone calls that I wasn't able to answer. I'll be back live next week. So join me next week. And hopefully we'll have a nice, smooth show. So, like I said, thank you, and I will see you next week.